It is a tremendous honor to host the director of the choir of Trinity College, Cambridge, Stephen Layton. Welcome to City Lights. And oh my goodness, this choir dates back to the 14th century. This is almost incomprehensible for those of us on this side of the pond to think about. City Lights executive producer Noel Morris not only adores this music and liturgy, but is an active participant herself. Noel Morris joins us with Stephen Layton now. Welcome.
Thank you, Lois. Stephen, I think the first thing we want to touch upon, you are in town to give a concert at Cathedral of St. Philip. But last night we got news of the passing of a real luminary in your musical world. Do you want to talk about that, Sir David Wilcox?
Indeed. Sad news that we all woke up to yesterday morning in this country, that Sir David Wilcox had passed away. Of course, he was a great age, in his 90s, and had been going strong as a conductor pretty much to the end of his life. A remarkable career, which I think was really set out by the defining sounds he made whilst directing the choir of King's College, Cambridge, in the late 50s, 60s, and early 70s. His reign in that building over that choir took place during a boom in the recording industry, in the days that we had vinyl records and millions of people bought such recordings. And in a way, the fact that those recordings became benchmarks for everybody was his great legacy, because he set standards which everybody could hear through the new media of recording. Of course, it was always the service at Christmas time that made that choir particularly famous. And he also, at that time of year, wrote some splendid Christmas music, which, of course, we sing now in all those famous carol descants that people hear at Christmas time.
That's right. And even people who don't know the recordings, but, you know, small town Iowa, wherever, his choir books are everywhere. He took traditional music and did arrangements that everybody uses.
Absolutely.
And we carry those broadcasts. We're proud to have carried them since they were available on this side of the pond. And he hosted quite well into his old age.
Let's listen. This is Jesu meine Freude of Bach, one of his performances that he conducted. We're listening to a recording of Sir David Wilcox conducting the choir of King's College, Cambridge. And he left us yesterday at the age of, what was he, 94?
95.
Yes. And had a tremendous footprint on the musical world. But I always find it so interesting, being American, to look at the tradition of English choral singing, because it's thousands, well, you know, it's over 1,000 years old, and it's continuous. It's people learning from the generation before them in an unbroken line to you, Stephen Layton, the director of the choir of Trinity College, Cambridge. Is that a little overwhelming?
No, it's not overwhelming. It's exciting, and it's something I'm very proud of being part of, because I see my little part of it as coming from a tradition of where young people, boys and now girls, will be singing every day in a British cathedral, a service of choral evensong, or indeed in a college chapel like in Cambridge. this music will be sung every day. And I, as a boy, did this myself in Winchester Cathedral from the age of 9 to 13. And I would wake up every morning at 7 o'clock. I'd have my breakfast, and at 8 o'clock, I would be rehearsing singing. I'd be singing Tallis and Bird, indeed the piece of Bach you just played. And this training, this daily nurturing, if you like, of singing is the secret to why we keep this alive in the United Kingdom today. And it's something very, very special. You know, this music of Tallis and Bird, we have the manuscripts of the music for sure. And they're kept in museums and libraries. Pretty much like a great painting would be kept in a museum in an air-conditioned room. But of course, the difference here is that to keep this music alive, it has to be sung. And really sung in context. And this great Renaissance period when Bird and Tallis and Gibbons and Tompkins and Wilkes, all these great giants of the English school, were writing, this music is synonymous with some of the finest buildings ever put up in the world.
Right.
These great, great cathedrals.
And there's so much history attached to that, even if you look at Bird versus Tallis, because those two were writing during a very,
very
violent time.
Very different, difficult times of political and religious change, where in England and indeed Scotland, Ireland and Wales, people didn't know one day whether it was going to be a Catholic type of reign or a Protestant type of reign, putting it very simply.
We're talking about the Protestant Reformation.
And right. A time when, you know, in London or in Oxford, sort of two major cities, the ordinary folk of the city could witness people being burnt at the stake, particularly bishops.
But those two guys were on opposite sides, right? Tallis always wrote his music in Latin, and Bird went to English. Isn't that right?
No,
or did I get that backwards?
they were sort of. It's slightly more complicated than that. In that they both wrote music in English and Latin. Tallis was a little older than Bird, but actually, of those two composers, Bird was probably the most Catholic. And he had to be quite secretive about it during the reign of Elizabeth I. So we know, well, we're pretty sure that some of his music was sung behind closed doors, i.e. around a dining room table in a big mansion house. But of course, on this tour, just it so happens, we're singing a piece that Bird wrote called O Lord, Make Thy Servant Elizabeth. Mm. Well, of course, he knew where his bread was buttered. And Elizabeth I's great sort of motto that we talk about in our history, and it's the sort of thing that children would get told in schools, was that as far as religious conformity took place, Elizabeth didn't want to make windows into men's souls. In other words, providing outwardly you towed the party line, which in her reign was Protestantism,
right,
you could have your Catholic thoughts inside you, and it was none of her business. And so Bird was probably a deep Catholic. We call him a recusant because he would do it in secret. And there are various priest holes in some of the big country houses that you can still see in England where Catholic priests were hidden during this time. Fascinating.
And those buildings still exist.
Absolutely. The most famous is called Ingatestone in Essex, just outside London. And that's actually also where Bird lived near there.
And you can hear music of William Bird tonight at Cathedral of St. Philip, sung by, right from the source, the choir of Trinity College, Cambridge. It's a school that was founded by Henry VIII.
Yes. There are many colleges in Cambridge. Trinity was founded by Henry VIII, King's by Henry VI, and in Oxford, Henry VIII also founded Christ Church. And it's interesting how these great seats of learning, their patrons were often royalty. In Trinity, because Henry VIII founded us, we have a splendid portrait of Henry VIII in the dining hall, which is from the sort of 1530s. And the chapel, which is a little later than that, was built just after Henry's time. But the whole complex of Trinity College, most famous for its great court, than the main sort of courtyard of the place, is very much in homage, if you like, to Henry VIII's supreme grandeur. This was the man, after all, who made himself the supreme head of the church in his country in the face of the Pope.
I'm curious about this thread you began speaking about writing in both English and Latin because certainly English is enriched so much by both the tradition of Romance languages and, of course, the Anglo-Saxon. And how much, even when they're writing in Latin, how much does just the beauty, the meaning, perhaps even the inflection of English inform this choral tradition?
That's a very good question. And I think it absolutely goes hand in glove with the way they constructed their musical phrases. So much so that when we look at the music of Bird and Talis today, set in this early English, we gather sometimes how they pronounced the English language and phrased it, sometimes differently to how we do today. Of course, you know, languages are never really set in stone, are they? They're sort of a developing art form, pretty much like music in some ways. I give a very good example of that from perhaps just 100 years after Talis and Bird, but it's one that just comes to mind. And that is the word P-R-A-Y-E-R. Now, if we were to say that word today, in London at least, I'm not going to try and say it how it might be said in Atlanta, but in London we would say prayer.
Yes.
In Henry Purcell's day, so this is sort of 17th century writing for Westminster Abbey in London, he would say prayer.
Oh.
Because we can see that in the settings of the music where this word is deconstructed into two distinct parts.
Two different notes.
Two different notes, indeed. So that this would be, if you sang it in the modern way, hear my prayer, O Lord. If you sang it as we suspect they did it because of the way it's notated according to the English language in those days, hear my prayer, O Lord. So that's just one tiny little example of what you might call a whole minefield of discussions of linguistics in the language. And of course, that's something that goes across all languages,
even
in the Latin as well. I mean, thinking about the Latin, I think, of course, the great cry of the Reformation was that the language that was used in the church should be the language that the ordinary people could understand to understand what the Gospels were about. Because I think it's fair to say that more people understood what was happening in the Latin language than they would today in those times. And there became, perhaps through the Latin language in the church, a sense of the devotion and the rhythm of it, which people kind of knew that those Latin words were celebrating the Eucharist or the communion, even though they wouldn't know absolutely every single text meant whatever, body, blood. Yeah.
I just appreciate your insight in that explanation, the beauty of what you said, because I think that it is the ultimate manifestation of the glory of the English language sung in your choral tradition, and you must have some examples you'd like us to hear.
Well, actually, what I'm looking at is one of your more recent CD releases, Stephen, where you've taken, and this still happens a lot, you take a traditional church text, a Latin text, and give it to a living person to write new music on it. And you've done that with American composer Stephen Stuckey.
Indeed.
Let's listen to... how about his O Vos Omnes? A little bit of that.
Excellent. That's the fourth track, yes. It's part of a series of three motets that he wrote in homage to Talis, O Admirabile Commercium, O Sacrum Convivium, and O Vos Omnes.
I hate to fade out of this very contemplative music. We've been listening to Vos Omnes by American composer Stephen Stuckey. Is this one of your commissions in memory of Thomas Tallis?
I didn't personally commission this set, although it is something that we've done quite a lot of by commissioning present composers to write old texts. But in fact, no, I discovered these pieces whilst on tour in this country a number of years ago and immediately fell in love with them because I think they represent a rather sophisticated take on these texts by Stuckey. In fact, although they're homage to Tallis, I think the main homage is actually by using the same texts as Tallis rather than trying to copy any sort of aesthetic principles of the way Tallis sets his own compositions.
Well, it's contemplative the way Tallis would be, but it's very chromatic.
Yeah, yeah. I think Vos Omnes, I suppose, has some polyphonic writing, but it's quite loose. But I think they're marvelous pieces, very, very successful also in a concert situation. So.
We have a word in this country that everybody loves to throw around a lot, especially when it comes to programming radio or even just any kind of public gathering, diversity. Mm. And I would love to talk about the diversity of your program that you've brought to Atlanta, because we start off with William Byrd from the 16th century. Yep. We go to Maurice Durufle, a Frenchman from the 19th century?
From 20th century.
Yeah. And then this Eschenwald. Tell us about him.
Yeah, he's from Riga and a Latvian composer. He was a fellow of Trinity College for 2 years. There's a post that's called a fellow in creative arts that we have, which various composers have had over the years. The present master or mistress of the Queen's Music, as it should be called, Judith Weir in the United Kingdom, was one such fellow, and Eric's follows in this path. He's in his mid-30s now, and we had a wonderful relationship with him in Cambridge when he was present at our sort of services in chapel and living in the college. And I think he was inspired by this choral tradition of hundreds of years in Cambridge to write new music. Of course, he comes from a tradition himself in Latvia that's very strong choral singing.
Yeah.
Not least tied very much to their politics when the country became free, or shall we say, when it last became free, because it's a country that's been under the control of many different other countries, but the last time free from the Soviet Union, most of the country marched singing to the capital, into Riga. And so he's very much part of a singing tradition. So it was interesting to see how he came to Cambridge and became part of another strong tradition and merged his voice with that English voice.
And continuing with your program of diversity, you've got a couple Americans on there. You've got Stephen Stuckey and Eric Whitaker.
Yeah.
Ratavara.
Yeah, well, I love Ratavara, and he would be less known, I think, to all audiences and perhaps to listeners. Finnish composer, still alive.
Yeah. And Arvo Pärt, Estonian?
Yeah, he will be known to everybody, you know, because his birthday was just last week on 9/11, in fact. He's 80. And several of these composers are also composers that I've had some association with over the years in either performing their pieces for the first time or recording them. And so partly the program is constructed just through those experiences I've had of enjoying their music.
We have to say goodbye. Stephen Layton, the director of the choir of Trinity College, Cambridge, your performance with the choir is tonight at Cathedral of St. Philip.
Phillips, I believe, at 8 o'clock this evening in the cathedral, and I understand there are still a few tickets left, so it'd be great to see folk there who would love to come and hear this choral music.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And I loved hearing you sing.